Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 434 for July 20th, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes.
I want people to remember me as being knowledgeable of the business, the craft, and someone who was fair and honest in dealing with them. I want people at the plant to remember me as a good manager.
And a good whiskey maker.
Oh, yeah. That was part of it. That's right.
We lost one of the legends this week, the one and only Elmer T. Lee. I had the chance to sit down for a chat with Elmer back in 2006, and we'll take a look back at one of bourbon's all-time greats in this week's Whiskey Cast in Depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, your voice, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department, all on this week's Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. As I just mentioned, Elmer T. Lee died this past Tuesday at the age of 93. He officially retired back in 1985 from what was then known as the George T. Stagg Distillery. It wasn't renamed Buffalo Trace until 1999. But right up until the end, he kept showing up every Tuesday to taste samples for the Elmer T. Lee Bourbon and visit the gift shop to sign bottles and tell stories for anyone, like the one he told me back in 2009 at Parker Beam's 50th anniversary celebration.
Jimmy Russell and Parker and I all date about the same period of time. I think I may outrank them in age a little bit, but Parker's celebrating his 50th. And I went to Jimmy Russell's 50th anniversary. And they came to my 90th birthday, so we all been around a while.
Tell me your best story about the times you guys had together.
Oh, gosh. The story I told my daughter on the way down here, Jimmy and I and the manager at our plant at the time was at a barrel symposium up in St. Louis. And after the presentation, they had a tasting. And a lot of wine people were there. And they was able to detect all sorts of fruits and vegetable tastes in the bourbon. And Jimmy Russell turned over to Joe Darman, the manager, and said, "I don't know about you, but we don't put any of that crap in our bourbon."
Now, Elmer really deserves a lot of the credit for today's bourbon renaissance. Back in 1984, he was the one who came up with the idea for Blanton's Single Barrel Bourbon. It was the first of its kind on the market and helped get people to take bourbon seriously again after years of declining sales. Again, more on Elmer T. Lee and his legacy later on. At the time of his death, Elmer was one of Kentucky's three living distillers to have bourbons named after them. Of course, Jimmy Russell and Parker Beam are the other two. Earlier this year, Parker announced that he was diagnosed with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, and Heaven Hill has pledged to raise $250,000 for the ALS Association and its Parker Beam's Promise of Hope Fund through donations from sales of this year's Parker's Heritage Collection bourbon. Now Parker's colleagues at six of Kentucky's largest distilleries are joining forces to help raise money for the Promise of Hope Fund. The distillers at Jim Beam, Maker's Mark, Buffalo Trace, Wild Turkey, Four Roses, and Woodford Reserve have supplied some of their best bourbons to be blended with Heaven Hill bourbon that Parker and his son Craig have selected. The result is 12 bottles of Master Distillers Unity. Two of them will be auctioned as a set, one to keep and one to drink, at the Bonhams Whiskey Auction in New York City October 13th. The other 10 will be poured the day before at Whiskey Fest New York for a special toast and tribute to Parker Beam. All of the proceeds from the auction will go to Parker Beam's Promise of Hope Fund. By the way, Heaven Hill hasn't officially released the details on this year's Parker's Heritage Collection bourbon yet, but Janet Patton of the Lexington Herald Leader reported this week that it'll be a 10-year-old bourbon bottled at 48% ABV and named Promise of Hope. In other news, it's the third straight week with a distillery groundbreaking to report. Balcones Distilling in Waco, Texas started construction of its new distillery in downtown. Chip Tate and his backers are turning a landmark Waco warehouse into a new home for the distillery. And they're also boosting capacity at the old welding shop that Chip turned into a distillery 5 years ago.
We're adding new capacity in our current distillery. Anyone who's been there knows there are limits to that. It's quite small. We only have about 1,500 square feet. So the main expansion, the one we're breaking ground on, is building just five blocks down. And 65,000 square feet, beautiful old 1923 building. We've been storing whiskey there. We'll be putting a really, you know, interesting new distillery in there in terms of a mixture of old designs and new designs on equipment. And that'll really put us in a different zone.
You're not going to build all the equipment this time, though, right?
No, I have no intentions of doing all that. There are limits. I'm building the equipment for, or most of the equipment, I should say, for the current plant. But for the new plant, no, I won't be building that. We'll be very happy to be working with Forsyth. They're quite busy these days, so we felt really fortunate to be able to work with them. And, you know, we have some other manufacturers doing various other things, but I'll just be directing traffic on that one.
Why'd you pick this building?
One part, it was obvious, it's near the current distillery, but in terms of which one we pick, it's a gorgeous part of Waco's history. It's one of the few multi-story buildings that survived the tornado of 53, and this is interesting, you know, in Waco's history. Little known fact, Waco was actually the biggest town in central Texas, bigger than Austin or Dallas or what have you before this tornado in 1953. So long and short, people took their insurance money and built outside of the city center. It really just sort of gutted the progression of the town. So we're trying to be part of the revival of Waco downtown, and this is one of those landmark buildings there. So it'll be fun to be right in the middle of everything as it evolves.
What does this give you as far as the ability to not only increase your production but come up with some more new stuff?
Yeah, I mean, both of those are great points. I mean, we'll build this in stages. Initially, it'll represent a big jump for us in terms of being able to make, 10 or 15 times more than we're making now. Still not a lot of whiskey in the grand scheme of things. Eventually, we'll be able to produce as much as many of the, I would say artisan but well-known single malt brands, for instance, a Balvenie or maybe even a Macallan. Whether we choose to grow that large or not is to be determined. We're going to really let the whiskey and the need for the whiskey dictate that. But what's so novel for us is to actually even have that as an option. We've loved the success and the enthusiasm we've gotten, but everyone, including us, is a little frustrated because you can't find it on shelves, So we love the support and the demand, but it's really more than time to add some capacity and take some of those new recipes that have been, flipping around in my head now for quite a while and make them actual.
The new distillery is expected to come online in early 2015. By the way, the latest issue of Whiskey Magazine came out this week with a feature on Balcones, and you can see the stills that Chip and his team welded together themselves. On that note, work has started on the new Tullamore Dew Distillery in Ireland. William Grant and Sons decided to make the investment in their own distillery after acquiring the Tullamore Dew brand in 2011. The whiskey is currently being produced under contract by Irish distillers at Middleton. And speaking of Middleton, got word this week that this year's vintage of Middleton Very Rare has just been bottled and will be at retailers soon. And Middleton's longtime master distiller, Barry Crockett, was honored this week with the Outstanding Achievement Award by the International Spirits Challenge. Barry retired earlier this year. You'll find more details on that in the news section at WhiskeyCast.com. A quick rundown now on this week's new whiskeys. Ben Riach is releasing 12 new single cask bottlings, ranging from 8 years old to 37 years old, with a 1998 cask that's very unusual. It's one of the few triple distilled malts in Ben Riach's warehouses. Weems Malts is releasing 6 new single casks, including one called The Smokery, a 1980 Kolila single malt. The Maltland range from Meadowside Blending in Glasgow has 5 new single casks, including a 30-year-old from Glenturret and a fairly rare 18-year-old bourbon cask from Glenrothes. Glengarry is releasing its first-ever Virgin Oak Matured Single Malt. The new whiskey will be available in the UK at first and in the US this October. And finally, Richard Patterson has come up with what may be the ultimate collection of Dalmore single malts, 12 bottles, with one dating all the way back to 1926. They're being sold as a set at Harrods in London, complete with Richard's handwritten journal describing each whiskey. The price for the Dalmore Patterson collection, £987,000, or about $1.4 million. On that note, a quick update on our story last week about executive departures at White & Mackay, which owns the Dalmore. In addition to former PR chief Rob Bruce and U.S. marketing manager Don Lambert, there's word now that Jorge Gutierrez, who was vice president for the Americas at White & Mackay, has also left the company, along with many of the White & Mackay sales reps in the U.S. As of now, there's still no word on Diageo's plans for White & Mackay now that it's taken control of United Spirits, which has owned White & Mackay since 2007. You can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long at WhiskeyCast.com.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Help us select the next Glenmorangie single malt whiskey with the Glenmorangie Caskmasters project. Sign up online through the Glenmorangie Facebook page or on glenmorangie.com.
Each month we pick one member of our global community at random from our registered members at WhiskeyCast.com to receive a free exhibition print from the WhiskeyCast Photo Gallery. Congratulations to June's winner, Jeremy Spikes. There's still time to register at WhiskeyCast.com for July's drawing. You'll find the photo gallery in the pub at WhiskeyCast.com. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker. Last time around, I mentioned the Google Maps error that put the entire Isle of Jura completely underwater and posted links to the map on WhiskeyCast.com and at our Facebook page. And that, as you might expect, resulted in some tongue-in-cheek responses. Matt Wohler suggested that it could be, in his words, the start of the zombie apocalypse and Jura has been quarantined indefinitely. Libby Turnbull in Edinburgh posted this note: had it been Isla, we could be drinking Brooklady Atlantis. Longtime listeners will remember the days when Brooklady would release a special bottling for almost any occasion, like the legendary WMD after they found out the CIA had been spying on them through their webcams, the WMD-2 Yellow Submarine after a mine-clearing sub washed up on shore near the distillery, the Brooklady Stiff Wind after the last storm. Okay, I'm kidding about that last one. But given the weather on Isla most of the time, that one could be a permanent part of the Brooklady range. Earlier this week, I posted the story on Master Distillers Unity. Scott Hartig responded with this comment: this gives me chills. Name another industry where the most notable competitors would join forces to blend their cherished products with each other, not only for a great cause, but to honor one of their own. Would Coke and Pepsi do this? Well, the answer is no. And that's what makes the whiskey business different from almost any other business. I made this point earlier this year at the World Whiskies Conference in New York. We all have brand loyalties. For instance, a lot of folks use Tide laundry detergent. But when was the last time you ever heard of Tide users visiting the Procter & Gamble plant where they make the stuff, let alone ask the plant manager to sign a bottle of it? But whiskey lovers do that every day at distilleries all over the world. One of our listeners, Dr. Eric Mortensen, did just that this week. He and his colleagues from the U.S. have been in London for a series of meetings, and they needed to get out of the city for an afternoon break. He asked me to suggest something whiskey-related, and I suggested they go up to Norfolk to visit the English Whiskey Company's distillery. And they did. Andrew Nelstrup and his team took great care of them. Eric shared some photos of their visit, and I've posted them on our Facebook page. If you have something you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, you can always post it on the Your Voice page at whiskeycast.com. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. The exhibit Scotch Whiskey from Grain to Glass continues through the end of this month at the Mitchell Library in Glasgow. Glenfiddich's final Spirit of a Nation tasting and adventure talk will be this Wednesday night in Cardiff, Wales, as part of the distillery's partnership with the UK's Walking with the Wounded. There's a Glenfarclas tasting at Julio's Liquors in Westboro, Massachusetts on Wednesday night, along with a Benriach tasting that same night at Sam Snead's House of Whiskey in Auckland, New Zealand, and a Buffalo Trace tasting sponsored by Arkwright's at the Stanton House Hotel in Stanton Fitzwarren, England. The Kensington Wine Market in Calgary will have a Japanese whiskey tasting on Thursday night, and Dry Dock Wines and Spirits in New York City will have a Bren whiskey tasting on the 26th. You might still be able to get tickets for the Whiskey Fringe in Edinburgh, August 9th through the 11th, along with the Whiskey Guild's annual Hudson River Whiskey Cruise in New York City on August 29th. Those are just a few of the 268 different whiskey events on the calendar right now at whiskeycast.com. There's bound to be one near you. The calendar of events is brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
Whiskey Cast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Kevin O'Gorman, master of maturation, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
We're very fortunate in Midleton to have two very, very good coopers, Ger Buckley, who's our head cooper, and Donny O'Regan, the other cooper. In fact, Donny's nickname is Duxer, but we won't go into that. So we have two very, very good coopers, and their whole emphasis is on the quality of the cask and the quality of the wood. And they spend basically 8 hours a day or even longer looking after our cask. Ger, for example, is a fifth generation cooper. So it's in his family, five generations. In the cooperage area, he does a lot of cask repair. Most of our cask repair now would be the sherry butts. Because they're quite expensive, we would spend a lot of time, if needs be, repairing sherry butts. So Ger has a great appreciation of wood. His whole life revolves around wood, be it at home or at work. He also does a lot of work here for us as well in terms of, you know, doing special casts or making up different types of wood products. And Duxer spends a lot of time on cask inspection, the American barrels coming in from the States and also the sherry butts. And again, the two of them together, their clear objective is quality of the wood, and that's really it.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
This week on Whiskey Cast In Depth, we remember Elmer T. Lee. After World War II ended, he studied engineering at the University of Kentucky, not far from his hometown in Frankfort. In 1949, he signed on at the George T. Stagg Distillery in Frankfort as an engineer. 20 years later, he was running the place. Back then, Chris Morris was a young distiller and spent time listening to and learning from Elmer T. Lee.
Well, I met Elmer well over 20 years ago when I was employed by United Distillers, which had been formed from, at least in the United States, from the combination of Shinley Distilleries and Glenmore Distilleries. I was on the Glenmore side. And Elmer, of course, had spent a lot of his career as a Shinley employee when that distillery was operated by Shinley. So we would talk about the history of the brands, the history of Shinley, the history of Blue Rose and Steel. So we really talked about his career at Shinley. I was very interested in that from a historical standpoint because of the legendary figure of Blue Rose and Steel. It's interesting to speak with someone like Elmer, in addition to Ralph Dukes, who actually knew one of the leading distillery owners in the history of the United States. So we had a lot of good discussions about those good old days, I guess.
And he was never hesitant to share those old stories, was he?
No, he loved to talk. I think as we all do.
What's his legacy to the bourbon business?
I think his legacy is just the fact that he was a classic Southern gentleman, a very hospitable, kind person who I think epitomized what you would hopefully think as a bourbon distiller would be. Very gracious and hospitable and quick to welcome you and share a story.
Elmer never really retired in 1985. He just stopped punching the time clock. The distillery honored him a year later with his own Elmer T. Lee single barrel bourbon, and he kept right on going, even after Sazerac bought the place and renamed it Buffalo Trace. In November of 2006, I sat down for a chat with Elmer during Whiskey Fest New York to get some of his stories firsthand.
It's been a long time, but how did you get involved in the whiskey business?
I grew up in the town that Buffalo Trace is located in, and I knew it from my kid up. After I got out of college with an engineering degree, they were looking for engineers, and I was interested. I went to work for them in 1949.
What was it like growing up around the distillery back then?
Everybody knew the distillery and the distillery people. They were friendly, a good place to work. It was just a sort of a big family atmosphere.
But it wasn't always that way. If I remember correctly, there were a number of those years when you were growing up when there wasn't a Buffalo Trace distillery because of the Great Experiment.
No, it operated during that period of time. One of the four distillers in Kentucky that continued to operate under a medicinal permit and made medicinal whiskey and bottled. And people who had a pain went to their doctor, got a prescription, got it filled. They could get four bottles a month, was it? Four pint bottles a month. And cured their ills.
I never quite thought of it as medicinal, but I can understand why.
It's labeled as such. You look at some of those old Prohibition era labels, and it says bottle for medicinal purposes.
Now, what happened after Prohibition ended and the distillery kicked back in full strength producing bourbon for everybody?
Well, there was, I don't know, 200 or 300 distilleries in Kentucky, and quite a number of them went under during the Prohibition era. So when they started back up, what year was it? 1933, 34. Why, of course, they didn't have any aged bourbon. They had to start all from scratch again. And they went full blast. They went good.
Tell me about your first day working at the distillery. What was it like to go in there on that first day back in 49?
It was a hustling place. At that time, there was about 400 people working at the plant. It was a big operation and a lot of people hustling around doing their thing. And my first day at the plant, I was just trying to find my way around the plant and find out what I was supposed to be doing.
And what did they have you doing?
I was an engineer, plant engineer, which meant that you took care of building needs, maintenance needs, new construction, new equipment, modernization, mechanization, the things that engineers do.
And how did you make the transition into distilling?
After about 12 years of this as an engineer, the plant was pretty well where they wanted it to be. And they offered me an opportunity to learn the distilling trade as a art and to understudy the master distiller and the plant manager. This I did, and after about 4 years, I became manager of the plant.
What to you makes a good bourbon?
What makes a good bourbon? Takes a good recipe. It takes a people who are interested in what they're doing and do it with pride and care and put it away in the warehouse and age it for the required number of years, bottle it, put it on the market.
Did you ever expect that you'd spend your entire life pretty much there?
No, I didn't. But after I was there a few years, like most people would, I shopped around in other industries and quickly decided that I was where I belonged, and I stayed with it.
Tell me about the average day when you go into a distillery. When you go in there, what's it smell like? What's it sound like? For those of us who've never been to a distillery, sort of paint that picture for us of what it's like in there.
You would be impressed, I think, with the sugar smell. It's a sweet, the mashing of the grains and the conversion over to with barley malt, the conversion over, you get a sweet smell, and this impermeates the whole area around there. This is what you'd witness or would be impressed with first, I think, is the smell. And then, if you was interested, you'd want to find out where that good smell was coming from and take a tour of the plant, and they'd offer you a little drink of their bourbon, and you'd like it.
What's the secret, in your opinion, to storing and aging bourbons? I know a lot of folks like to rotate the barrels around the warehouses and stuff like that, and what's your secret? What do you think makes it age so well?
Well, the territory we're in is Kentucky's climate is constantly changing. The Army guys had a good word for it, said if you don't like the weather in Kentucky, just wait a few minutes. You know, it's going to change. The changing seasons, the changing weather is very important to the aging of bourbon.
How so?
With the increased temperatures that occur, it forces the whiskey in the barrel into the wood, and the wood is, of course, got a lot of sugars and taste characteristics about it that when it cools off and withdraws from the wood, it brings those tastes with it. You get all of the most of the taste and all of the color comes from the barrel, the aging process. When it's first made, it's clear as water and put in a barrel, and in a few days it'll pick up some color and will start to take on characteristics of bourbon.
Now, I know that a lot of people differ on the amount of aging a barrel should have. What's your opinion? What's the ideal age for a bourbon?
It depends on a person's preference, taste. But to my taste, 7 to 10 years is where it reaches its peak, I think.
Does it go downhill after that in some ways?
Depends on your taste preference. It does change taste as it ages. Pick up more of the tannins, more of the wood taste. If you like that, you like it older. If you don't care for it too much, you'd prefer it at 8 to 10 years age.
Now, what's changed about the industry over the years, both good and bad? What don't you like about the way things have changed, and what do you like?
Well, there's not many things that I don't like about it. There has been a change, of course, in the equipment, modernization, mechanization, computer control, this sort of thing, which is good, I think, because it gives you better control of your process. So you put out a product that's consistent year in and year out. Those are the good things, I think. The bad things, and they're not really bad, but I hate to see the thing become too mechanized and too modernized. It takes the romance out of the operation.
And whiskey making really is sort of a romantic, passionate type thing, a still maker or still man handing, working over the still, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, you retired a few years ago officially, but do you miss it?
Well, not too much because I go in quite frequently. I retired 20 years ago, and I still go into the plant on a routine basis once a week, do a series of tastings of the single barrel products, and serve on a committee that selects barrels for single barrel production. Then I touch base with folks like Angela and Mac and the personnel people, the gift shop. You know, I just make myself at home and roam around.
How do the bourbons today compare? Because you talked about being able to get more consistency with computer control. Are the bourbons of today just as good as the bourbons you were making back in the 40s and 50s?
Yes, it certainly is. In fact, it may be a little better because of the consistency. With the controls that's now on the process with instruments and computer and people who pay attention to what they're doing, you put out a more consistent product, and it's a good product. I think it's better than what we did in the 30s.
I know your colleagues over in Scotland would say that the whiskeys they were making back in the 50s and 60s are superior to what they're making today just because of changes in barley and things like that. But it's interesting to hear you say that you're actually making better bourbon now than you did 30, 40 years ago.
To my taste, yes, we're making better bourbon.
I have to ask, since you're talking about taste, how do you take your bourbon?
How do I taste it? Well, at the tasting panel, you have some distilled water, rinse your mouth with distilled water, and then you take a sip of the product that you're tasting, swirl it around in your mouth, let your taste buds in contact with the product, and if you like it, why, you like it, you know, you spit it out, and then you do the same thing for the next sample that you...
If I remember reading correctly in your bio, you're sort of the one who came up with the idea of marketing single barrel bourbons. Am I correct on that? Why did you come up with that idea? How did you come up with it? And what did the folks at the distillery say when you said, let's do single barrels?
The owners of the plant at that time was looking for a premium product that they wanted to be in competition, so to speak, with the single malt scotch program, which was very successful. So I was manager at the plant at the time, and they came to me and says, what would you do? How would you suggest we come up with a premium product? And I remembered some of the things I had learned when I first went to work there from Colonel Albert Blanton. Whenever he wanted bourbon for his own personal use and for entertainment, he'd go to his favorite warehouse and ask him to bring him samples out of aged bourbon, 7, 8, 10 years old. He would sip them, and he would pick a particular barrel and say, bottle that one, that's the one I want. This sounded like a pretty marketable idea to the people that owned the plant. So they said, we'll come up with a single barrel bourbon. So the first one was Albert, named after Blanton, Albert Blanton.
Tell me about Colonel Blanton.
Well, I only worked with him 4 years before he retired. He was a true Kentucky gentleman, quiet, good-natured, knew his business, had a great love of the plant and the products. He was part owner of the property at that time. He was a real gentleman. I like Colonel Blanton.
And now we're looking 40, 50 years later, and now you've got your name on a bottle of bourbon.
Yeah, I have. When I retired in 1986, the owners at that time said, Elmer, we'd like to name a bourbon after you. I said, fine, you can do it. provided you let me pick the bourbon. So they agreed, and I'm picking the bourbon for it still.
And what do you look for when you pick that bourbon?
Something that's very mild and mellow to my taste. I like the caramel, the sweetness that I get from it, the vanilla, oaken flavors, all of those things that are pleasing to my taste is what I look for.
I know that you and Jimmy Russell are the only two distillers alive that have a bourbon named after you. That's got to be something of a matter of pride for you.
It is. There was three of us, of course, Booker Knoll, who's now passed away, but they're the only three distillers that I know that have a bourbon named for them. Jimmy Russell's, Russell's Reserve, Elmer T. Lee, and Booker's.
Let me ask you one final question. What do you want your legacy to be in this business? How do you want people to remember you 20, 30 years from now?
I want people to remember me as being knowledgeable of the business, the craft, and someone who was fair and honest in dealing with them. I want people at the plant to remember me as a good manager.
And a good whiskey maker.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was part of it. That's right.
And that's how Elmer T. Lee will be remembered, a good man who made good whiskeys. Our condolences go out to Elmer's daughter, Peggy, and the entire Lee family, along with his friends and colleagues at Buffalo Trace. And that's this week's Whiskey Cast In Depth. There's just one whiskey that needed to be tasted this week for the What I'm Tasting This Week department. While I've had the Elmer T. Lee Single Barrel Bourbon many times before, I'd never actually done tasting notes on it until now. It was hard to find a bottle, too, but well worth searching for. Elmer picked every cask personally. They were bottled at 45% ABV. The nose is very rich with notes of honey, oak campfire smoke, allspice, mild cinnamon, and dark chocolate. The taste, peppery with undertones of honey, rye bread, toasted oak, dark chocolate, and vanilla. And the finish is long and smooth with just a bite of spice. It's a bourbon worthy of Elmer T. Lee's name, and I'm scoring it a 92. Cheers, Elmer. You'll find my searchable tasting notes for more than 1,000 different whiskeys at the WhiskeyCast website, along with WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes, the latest whiskey news, the calendar of events, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is whiskeycast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive Whiskey Tasting Journal.
Whiskey Cast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.